Welcome back, friends, listeners from around the globe. It's good to have you here. This is Red Eyes Radio, and I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. This is a program not only dedicated to truth and exposing the lies in history and modern times, but also for the preservation of our beautiful Norse traditions, heritage, ancient past, and our people. We have yet another groundbreaking program for you today. A gentleman whose work many of you already know is with us to tread into new territory. John Lash is a comparative mythologist, author, and teacher. And last time he was with us, we thought it would be his last interview. However, he has decided to break that silence and come back on the program due to the urgency and importance of the topic that we'll be talking about today. John is the author of Not in His Image. His focus has been on the Abrahamic religions as compared to the Gnostic pre-Christian and, if you will, pagan traditions and the connection to the Archons. Today we're going to expand and get a massive update on his work and a look at it from a new angle. Our extended segment today is on white genocide and the Archontic infection. Very interesting. Stay with us. And welcome back, John. It's great to have you with us again. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for the invitation. It's been quite a while, hasn't it?
It has been quite a while. I've been an admirer of your work ever since we first came across it here, really, many years ago. I've gotten so much good stuff out from our discussions over the years, John, and it's always good to have you on the line and speaking with you. But today here, obviously, we're going to continue to pry into the predicament that we find ourselves in and discuss one of the major issues, if not the issue, that we are faced currently with here. And we kind of know where we want to go. We know what we need to address here. So I'm just going to kind of go for the jugular right away here, John. If there is a clear and present danger of this kind of a final solution for white Europeans and their descendants, who is masterminding this program? What is the cause of so-called white genocide, and how can it be stopped, John?
Well, that is certainly a question that's much on my mind these days, and you and I have agreed that we're going to focus on that as the theme for this conversation, and perhaps for another follow-up interview not too long from now. I've come to the conclusion since I talked to you last. When was that? I guess it was September 2012 or something like that.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, I've come to the conclusion that this issue of white genocide is a major planetary issue. And I'd like to make it really clear what I mean by that. I mean that it's not just a matter of concern for white people, people who identify as the white races of Europe, and they're also of Russia and even of other places in the world, like, you know, Iranians, you know, are white, Caucasian people in general. If this is really a clear and present danger, which is a military term, for something that you're not imagining to happen, okay, but something that is actually happening, then it's not just a matter of concern for the people who are targeted. It's a matter of concern for the entire planet. And so I want to say, first of all, that those who are tuning into this interview should not think that we are being selective or partial or exclusional in any way by taking on this subject. The understanding of who is masterminding this program and why and how to stop it is not merely the concern of the so-called whites, but it's a concern of all human beings who want a better future for this planet.
Why is that? Just explain that a little bit, because some people might argue, you know, this has been more trouble than good stuff has come out of evil European colonialism and everything else. And it's kind of, I've gotten the sense of it that some people are actually cheering this on, John. They're actually, they like that they see what's happening right now.
Well, yes, they do. And in fact, there's an attitude. I can hear the rumbling and the groaning out there in the minds of some people. And there's this attitude, well, it's about time the white folk got their medicine because of all the evil that they've done on this planet. Now, I was concerned that this point would come up in the interview, And I don't want to consume the interview in refuting or addressing this point too long.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
But it could be distractionary. But let me see if I can make a few points clear. First of all, the notion going around, the claim that white people, Caucasians, white Europeans, and then those who went to America have perpetrated more evil more systematically and massively on this planet than any other of the racial groups is entirely false. It's entirely and absolutely false. You know, white people throughout history, let's just talk about recent history, you know, since, say, the Renaissance, have done their share of harm. But they also have done a huge share of good on this planet. As you know, the image of the white slaver is a Hollywood image of sadism and tyranny and domination. But as a matter of fact, the amount of white people in the United States who actually had slaves was minute, wasn't it?
Yes.
When you go and look into the history, when you go and look into the statistics, in the actual facts, you find that the case against whites as colonialist, sadistic dominators is completely biased and not based on facts. Jews and Arabs contributed to slavery as much on this planet as anyone else. The Chinese contributed to slavery. So the whole record is terribly skewed, and it gets in the way of, it's sort of like the smoke on the battlefield. You know the term, the fog of war?
Yes.
Well, we're in a war over this white genocide issue. And it has to be defined very clearly, but it can be difficult to see the terms of the war because there is a fog of war and there's a fog of disinformation and there's a massive program to demonize white people and a lot of people who feel disenfranchised for one reason or another, whether they be Latinos or blacks, buy into this. And so I don't want to get bogged down in that subject before we start this interview because we have other things to get to. But I can perhaps offer a tool to cut through all of that fog. I could be called a white supremacist, surprisingly, because of some of the things I'm going to say in this interview and some of the things I'm going to say for the rest of my life. And I want to make it, and I could be called a racist and all those things, and I want to make it clear that I hold everyone out there listening to me to the same standard of sobriety and discernment to which I hold myself, so that we can look at this problem with sobriety and intelligence and not become hysterical and not submit to what Wilhelm Reich called the emotional plague. That is, wild, irrational, emotional projections flying in one direction or another. And as a remedy and a tool to keep our minds focused clearly on a common goal, I offer the word excellence. Excellence. I am not a white supremacist, but I am a champion of white excellence. But I'm also a champion of black excellence. And of Latino excellence, and Chinese excellence, and Russian excellence. And so I say to everyone who's listening to this, us talk about this difficult topic, don't get lost in the fog of war. Don't get thrown by the word racism. Let's just consider what is the excellence coming out of every racial and ethnic group in the world. And let us recognize and honor the excellence in each other, and by doing so, unite and get past the obstacles of racism and false claims about who has done what in the course of history. I hope that's helpful.
Well, exactly. I agree with you. I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, just briefly here, from my point of view, this particular angle has been, in my view, a natural development from basically all the other topics that we've covered as well in the past, from conspiracy to geopolitics and the suffering that has been going on globally. And to me, it's so blatantly obvious when you see this in the media and how it's treated, of course, in the news press and you know, television shows and Hollywood and everything else, that the people in power has a clear and distinct agenda, not only to cause these kinds of tensions between the races and everything else and use it to their advantage, but you can see that there is a long-term plan here of replacement level immigration into Europe and into America too, for that matter. And the some of the response to this has been actually quite positive as well. I mean, you can see that people, if you can explain it in a rational way, as you said, without that kind of emotional barrier between people where you just get riled up and angry right away, I think most people who are honest about it can actually see it and in a very clear and logical, rational approach, begin to deconstruct it. But obviously, some people have been reacting in the way, just as you kind of explained, John, as well, that you need to like explain, defend yourself even before you go into the topic, because that's how programmed people are these days. And I think that that's a sign in itself, that if you can't even bring up these topics for the sake of being called names out through the gates, that indicates what kind of climate that we are in currently, and the very fact that so many people have fallen for this propaganda, John.
Well, you said it very well, and it is a tremendous impediment to a clear and compassionate understanding of this problem. If there is an agenda of white genocide, and I believe there is, and I believe I can say something about why, both in terms of ordinary political programs and also from the supernatural angle, you know, which is very important. There is a supernatural angle operating here. But if this is the case, then it's a concern for everyone. It's a concern for humanity as a whole. You know, if any race were to be systematically targeted for destruction, it would be a concern for the whole human family. So as a human family, we have to know who our enemies are. And that's not hard, because they've told us in their own words, haven't they?
They sure have, yeah.
That's right, you know. If you go and look into the ethics of various races and cultures through the ages, for instance, you can say, what were the ethics of the ancient Persians? You know, what were the ethics of pagans in the pagan world in Europe? What were the ethics of the American Indians, you know? And you can, if you go, as I do, as an anthropologist and mythologist, and you examine these cases from around the world, what were the ethics of the Australian Aborigines, you know? And what is their self-identity? How do they define themselves? Well, you'll find, as far as I know, that there is only one case on the entire planet of a people, call them a nation, call them a race, although I don't like this word race, because in my mind, the only race is the human race. There's just one race, okay? But if you examine the spectrum, to my knowledge, there is only one nation and race which first defined themselves by absolute separation from the rest of humanity, placing themselves in a supremacist and dominant position. Don't they wish? And second, who have stated over and over again, textually and in their religious and political programs, a statement to deceive, dominate, and destroy all races that do not belong to their self-designated category. Now, the fact that there is only one instance of that on the entire planet ought to be enough to set off some alarm bells in the minds of sober and rational people, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And like I've said before, like I used to say, when people ask me, well, John, the Gnostics said that there was one predatory species, the Archons, who are preying on the human race, and we have to know about them, their origins, their methods, their agenda, in order to protect ourselves. Well, But John, why do you say that there's always only one? Couldn't there be more? And my answer is, well, one is all it takes, pal.
Yeah.
One is all it takes, you know? There's a mosquito called Anopheles mosquito. It carries malaria. You can get bitten by dozens of species of mosquitoes, other mosquitoes, and you don't get malaria. But if an Anopheles bites you, you do. Well, one is all it takes. And one is all it takes for one self-designated, self-identified faction of the human race to separate itself ideologically and religiously into a supremacist position and declare that it is going to enact war and destruction and enslavement upon the rest of the human race. And this is a very great fact. This is not my interpretation. This is not an anti-Semitic fantasy I have. In fact, it is the fantasy of those who have it.
Right. Yeah.
And it deserves to be treated as a full-blown paranoid psychosis. And so I would say to you, before we go into other aspects of the subject, because this is very impromptu, our conversations, and you know how I am, I don't repeat myself, and I always talk in a raw feed. There is a dangerous paranoid psychosis operating in a certain faction of the human race. And the white genocide problem is a symptom of that. It is the leading symptom, and I'll tell you why in the course of this conversation, why the people who carry this psychotic disease have to target the whites. There's a very specific reason why. But if that is the case, it is a problem in the midst of the human species and a problem that needs to be faced by all families, all ethnic families, all national identities, and all racial categories of humanity. I can't emphasize this too much.
Right. Yeah. So there are a couple of clear kind of, and by all means, John, you have a you know exactly where you want to go with this as well. So don't let me get you too much off keel or kilter here. But obviously, just as a reminder for people as well, there are a couple of clear and distinct examples of this that we've heard in the recent years of the ongoing, attempt and plan to, for example, bring in mass immigration into Europe. We have people like Barbara Spector out of, Stockholm getting taxpayer money, sitting and talking quite openly about this. Even the very idea that she claims that all Jews will be responsible for this and therefore they will be resented. We have, former NATO general as well talking about this. We have Nicolas Sarkozy in France, Peter Sutherland in Ireland, Kudenhof Kalergi, the founder of the European Union. These are people that come into our awareness all the time, kind of repeating these types of sentiments. So this is a clear and present danger. So why don't we try to get kind of a little bit closer into what drives this and what the motivation behind this is, John?
Okay, all right. Now I'm going to answer that and sort of set a direction for this interview by just dropping back a little, if I may, to describe to your listeners, some of whom may know me, most of them probably, others who don't, how it is that I have come to focus on this particular issue, quote, white genocide, unquote. Because up until now, in my writings, and in my work as a teacher, in the Gaia Navigation Experiment, and pretty much in everything I've done, I have never taken a position of this kind. I'm taking a position now. I'm taking a political, sociological position on this issue. And this is new for me. I guess you probably know this.
Yeah.
From your knowledge of my work, it's quite extensive, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And it's actually our common concern, Henrik, yours and mine, for this issue that brought us back together, isn't it?
That's correct, yep.
That's right. So I'd like to tell readers, just to take a bit of time here, to tell you how I came to take this position. As you know, I restored the materials of Gnosticism from their very pathetic and sparse condition, with the intention of doing two things. I delved into the materials, the historical received materials of Gnosticism, such as the Nag Hammadi codices, and I restored the message of Gnosticism to the best of my ability, but as no other scholar has done. That is to say, I presented a Sethian view of Gnosticism, which is a pre-Christian and anti-Christian view, and also an anti-Judaic view. That's in contrast to most scholars who have presented Gnosticism as sort of a cast-off version of Christianity, or at best, a heretical version of Christianity. So I'm known for having done that. I'm also known for having restored the Sophianic myth of the Gnostics and reconstructed it. In the process of doing that work, which I summarized in Not in His Image, I got deeply involved in the myth of the Aeon Sophia, the wisdom goddess. Now, this myth is not really a myth in the sense that it is a falsity or a lie or a deliberately deceiving construction. You know, as a mythologist, I use the term myth simply to mean a powerful narrative that contains truth. Very often it's a mythopoetic narrative. For instance, if you take the mythopoetic narrative of creation in the Eddas, in the Scandinavian and Icelandic mythology, you have the story of Ymir, the first man. You have the story of the great cow goddess who licked the salty ice and produced the great man. And all this is a myth which describes actual events that happened in the origin of our species on this planet. So I consider a myth to be, there are myths that are, of course, deliberate lies, but you must distinguish them from myths which carry deep, deep and essential truths. So I've been deeply involved in this Sophianic myth. I've involved other people in it as well. And it has very unique features, as you know. It's really incomparable. And I can tell you that there is no other myth on the planet that explains the origin of the human species, the origin of the Earth itself, the presence of extraterrestrial parasites, and many, many other things. The fallen goddess scenario explains all these things. At the same time, it is a participatory myth. It means that it doesn't merely present information, but it engages you to participate. It's like a film plot. You're invited to be part of the making of a film. You're invited to play a role in that film, and yet the end of the film hasn't been written yet. Do you get that point?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about the Sophianic myth. The end of it has not been written yet. And so there is a clue in the Gnostic writing, which only occurs, I think, in three occasions. You find this Greek word, diorthosis, which is translated as correction. And according to the Gnostics, correction is an event that will happen, can happen on this planet at some particular moment. Now, they were speaking of correction as happening in the future. They were wiped out around 400 AD. But in their tradition, up until 400 AD, going back many millennia, they cultivated and developed the myth of the Aeon Sophia, who is a goddess from the Pleromic core, the galactic center, who was transformed into the Earth. She is the Earth. The Earth is the body of the Aeon Sophia. And they said that there are anomalies and errors that occurred in the course of the evolution of humanity and of the Earth, which are all described at length in this myth, as you know. And they said that at a certain moment, that the Aeon Sophia herself would correct those problems. Now that, to me, when I first encountered it, you can imagine the impact that had on me. Because no other myth makes any such claim whatsoever. And additional to that, I understood from the specific language of certain passages that this correction of the Aeon Sophia could only happen successfully, fully across the planet, affecting all humanity, if she had a certain number of human collaborators. And so, I found myself engaged in a fantastic proposition, in a fantastic adventure. What is Sophia's correction? What is to be done by human witnesses who know her story and who follow the Sophianic myth, which is the story of the living Earth and the intelligence of the Earth and how to interact with it? And at first, I was very, very hesitant to define her correction. When I wrote "Not in His Image," I held back. I said, I'm not going to speculate because I don't really know what Sophia's correction is. I don't know what the Gnostics were anticipating. You know, I've often said, Henrik, I don't teach what I already know. Of course, I do to some extent. But primarily, I teach what I am learning.
Right, yeah.
And I am learning right now what is Sophia's correction. And I am living in the moment of her correction, as is the whole planet since March of 2014. Now, when I realized, much to my amazement, that I would actually be living at the moment in history when Sophia's correction happened, I made an attempt to teach that to people and orient them to it, which was called the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And that experiment extended from March of 2011, the time of the Fukushima event, until March of 2014. It was a three-year-long experiment in which I delivered about 28 briefings on gaiaspora.org, which was the platform set up for the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And so then, correct, there was a reset period of 3 years. It took her 3 years to reset this whole planetary experiment in her mind. And from the 14th, from March 2014 onward, the reset begins to happen in the events of the world, okay? This is the general picture. Of course, it's a vast panorama that I'm portraying. But to get to the point of white genocide, when I realized this spring that Sophia's correction was underway, I also realized that there was an aspect of the Gnostic teachings that I had not exposed before to the world, at least not in the way that was satisfactory to me. Now, the Gnostic teaching is complex and beautiful. It does require, you know, a certain degree of intellectual capacity to grasp it. Yeah. And it requires, though, really, it speaks really to the visionary part of the human mind and to the empathy, your empathy with the earth. You know, if you have empathy with the earth, just think about the possibility that you could have a direct interactive connection with her. Well, this is possible through the application of the Gnostic teachings and what I call the telestic method of shamanism. So, but I realized that in spite of all my efforts to teach this and get it out into the world, there's one essential point that I had not put front and center in my presentation. And it's that essential point that connects directly to the problem of white genocide. So I could say that the message of Gnosticism, as I have recovered it and developed it, actually contains the key factor leading to the recognition of what is white genocide and who's doing it and also how to overcome it. And so that's why this topic has come up on my agenda at this time. Is that clear so far?
Definitely, yes.
Because I really feel responsible, you know, Henrik, to talk to the people who follow my work and who follow my presentation of Gnosticism to explain to them why I'm taking this position.
Sure. Oh, of course. No, definitely. I definitely understand that. And just the idea, too, that you know, trying to, you know, connect these dots here between these maybe at first seemingly very, very different topics, but, you know, to do it in such a way to show that there is actually a connection between them. And also just this idea, because I feel, and anyway, personally, that it's very much connected with, you know, the natural order of things, the wisdom that is contained in nature and the reason and purposes that we all find ourselves on this planet, you know. So I think it's important to talk about that.
Well, you're absolutely right, because there's something unnatural and anti-natural happening in this world, and the extermination of any human race that's not infected is an unnatural thing. The extermination of infections is a natural thing. That should get some attention. The extermination of infections is natural to the social organism of humanity, as it is natural to the human body. If your body gets an infection, you have an immunological system that will fight it off, right?
Yeah.
And what are the cells in that immunological system called?
White blood cells.
Right. White blood cells. Leukocytes. And so what I would give this term, speaking as a Gnostic and as someone who investigates occult and supernatural phenomenon, I would introduce the term leukocyte. There's a leukocyte going on. And where is the leukocyte coming from? Where is the impulse coming from that would destroy the white blood cells of humanity? You see? Well, let me take you directly back to the Gnostic material. I can't tell you how fantastic it is that the Gnostic material contains the sole, coherent, and consistent explanation of life on this planet, of any myth ever produced by the human mind. That is a fact. And I'm going to add something else. It also contains a warning. The Gnostics warned us. And they just did not just warn us, hey, folks, you've got an extraterrestrial predator on your back, the Archons. No. They warned us specifically about something else. So I'm going to read this passage. I want to make it perfectly clear where this passage is coming from. It's one paragraph, two sentences. And this is not from the surviving Gnostic materials in Coptic or Greek. It is from Irenaeus, who was an early Christian ideologue who wrote against the Gnostics, right? There were numerous of those. And Irenaeus wrote a book called Against Heresies, in which he condemned many of the beliefs and practices of the Gnostics. Now, it's very interesting that this piece of intel I'm going to give you right now comes from Irenaeus, which is, as it were, the dossier of the prosecution against the Gnostics. There is good reason to believe that this is accurately what the Gnostics thought, because Irenaeus is exposing it as heresy. It outraged him terribly. It made him and his contemporaries terribly angry that the Gnostics claimed what is said in this paragraph. This is from Irenaeus, Book 1, Chapter 30, Section 10. Quote, Yaldabaoth himself chose a certain man named Abraham from among the nations and made a covenant with him to the effect that if his seed continued to serve him, the Archons would give to them the earth for their inheritance. Afterwards, second sentence, by means of Moses, Yaldabaoth brought forth Abraham's descendants from Egypt and gave them the law and made them Jews. End quote.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that's a warning. And even though it doesn't come intact in the pitiful remains of the Gnostic writings, it is an accurate and exact reflection of what the Gnostics wanted to tell humanity. That there is a self-designated racial faction who made a pact with the Archons. And so, there is a supernatural factor behind the Jewish agenda. To put it in plain English, according to the Gnostic warning, the Jews who follow the agenda of racial supremacy and domination of the Goyim are proxies of the Archons.
Huh. Interesting.
Now, I've written a lot about the Archons, and I've also written somewhat about the Jews in my book, you know, but I've never emphasized the paramount importance of this passage. This is absolutely of paramount importance. Let's turn around now and let's see what happens if we put this statement up against Barbara Spector's statement. Okay?
Yeah.
Barbara Spector states, and I find it something about it quite funny, by the way, that I have to mention. But Barbara Spector states that the Jews are behind a program to annihilate the culture and identity of the white European peoples. Isn't that what she says?
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah. The part that makes me laugh is she being disingenuous or what, when she says, in a very serious, like a serious little child, oh, and Jews will be resented for this. Oh, really? Will they? Well, what a big surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that amazing, Barbara?
Yeah.
That Jews would be resented for deliberately executing a program to destroy the culture, identity, and history of white European peoples.
And that is genocide, well, by the way.
And that is the very definition of genocide.
Yeah.
So what I'm telling you is Barbara Spector is out of her fracking mind. And she has the archonic infection. And the archonic infection is the subject of the moment, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I have to add a caveat here. I'm going to say some things in the course of this interview that I can't totally verify. I am always transparent about what I do. I don't claim to be infallible. However, I do have an infallible method, and time again, it has been proven that when I use this method or tool correctly, I come up with the truth. This method is the Telestic method of investigation used in the ancient mysteries. It is called instruction by the light. This is the secret of the mysteries that was never spoken verbally, externally, and never even written about until I wrote about it in Not in His Image. So I broke a vow of silence that was held by people in the mysteries for thousands of years in order to disclose this method to the world. And I practice this method. It's a method of shamanic investigation by which you enter an altered state, which I call a cognitive trance. You are totally sober. You are more than lucid. You do not hallucinate. You do not close your eyes. And in this cognitive trance, you pose questions to the light which you see, which is the organic light, which is actually the naked body of the Aeon Sophia herself. You converse with the goddess in an ecstatic state of knowing. This is what they did in the mysteries, and you come away with intel that you cannot acquire otherwise. So take it or leave it. Consider me to be anything you like. I'm sure there are people who are saying John Lash is a mythomaniac, he's a megalomaniac, he makes up these things and he passes them off for cosmic truth. Say anything you like. I'm completely transparent about what I'm doing. I'm not hiding anything, okay? On the basis of such investigations, Henrik, I am now deep into an investigation of what I am going to call, for the first time in this interview, the archontic infection. Now, many people already use the meme of a virus when they refer to the Archons, don't they?
Sure do, yeah.
And in fact, in classical times, they used the term virus. Even in the New Testament, the term plague carrier is applied to Paul. Saul of Tarsus is called a plague carrier. He's carrying the Archontic virus, which he acquired from the Zadokim sect of the ancient Hebrews. The origin of the Archontic intrusion upon humanity is not the entire Hebrew people, whoever they were, largely a fiction, but a specific cult called the Zadokites. And down through history, the term plague or virus or infection has been used and applied to the Archons. You've certainly come across that meme many times, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it is also, I must say, and get ready for this, folks, has been applied to Jews, okay?
Mm.
Who are, as it were, the carriers of that virus in a particular way. Now, here's where the seat gets hot. I'm only in the middle of this investigation, and it might be premature to start discussing it, but I don't think so, since the world is on the verge of World War III. Well, what the hell? Here goes. Okay?
All right.
Up until now, Henrik, as you know well, I have considered the Archonic factor as an ideological virus, haven't I?
Yeah, exactly. I believe so.
I have said, for instance, that the ideology of salvationism, the master race or chosen people paradigm, the Messiah, the divine sacrifice of the Messiah, the final judgment of the world, those elements are components of a complex. I called it the Palestinian Redeemer complex. And I said that that complex, that belief system, which was seeded in the Zadokite cult of the Jews, it went pandemic in Christianity, and then it metamorphosed again into Islam. That particular belief system is an ideological virus planted in the human mind by an extraterrestrial species. I said that, didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
That's not my idea. You know that, don't you?
Yeah.
I take that from the Gnostic materials, and I can back up every part of that proposition by direct quotes in the Gnostic materials. Okay?
Yep.
But until now, this message has reached a lot of people, and I think it's been very liberating. But it's only the soft core version, folks. According to the soft core version that I've been teaching so far, consistent with the Gnostic materials, the Abrahamic religions are an ideological virus. Now, I'll give you the hardcore version. It's a neurological virus as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. It's a neurological virus. Now, I have made that conclusion based on my investigations using my shamanic methods, okay?
Yep.
Anyone who wants to dismiss me at this point and turn off the program is welcome to do so. But I will tell you this, that you will never, ever know. I can promise you this. No one on this planet will know ultimately what is happening to destroy humanity unless you have access to supernatural intel. It cannot be understood solely from an ordinary state of mind. You have to go into non-ordinary altered awareness and investigate it soberly, as the Gnostics did. And so I'm saying to you, reject what I say at your own risk. But regardless of whether you believe it or not, that there is an archonic neurological infection raging on this planet, I can assure you that you will never figure out what's happening to humanity, and you'll never be able to solve it unless you can accept the supernatural factor. How that virus got into the human brain, and it is in the human brain. My investigations so far tell me that it is masked by a chemical in the brain called L-DOPA.
L-DOPA.
That's right. L-DOPA is an important neurochemical related to dopamine. So these are chemicals in the human brain. They're in everybody's brain, right? We all have the same neurochemistry in our brain, right?
Yeah. As far as I know.
Wrong. We don't. Some human animals have a narcotic infection in their neurological circuits. And this is material.
Meaning there is a... Is there a change in the chemical makeup of the brain once we can talk about how the infection takes place, but once it's there is a chemical difference in the brain.
Yes, there is. But that chemical difference would be detectable. And I take a risk here. In fact, I challenge future, present and future neurochemists to verify what I'm saying. It would be detectable, but not easily detectable, because the nature of this virus is very insidious and deceptive. It's a virus that disguises itself, as some viruses and diseases are known to do, right?
Yeah.
This virus is the trickster virus, my friend. It is not just a virus like any other virus that a human animal or other animal might contract, but it's a virus that is possessed of a diabolical trickster intelligence. And so it disguises itself in the brain. So one could make an analysis of someone's brain who had this infection and not see it because it is masked. It is masked behind L-DOPA.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to bring up something here that is a good reference for those of you readers who like to go out and do their own investigation, okay? I will give you an indication of two directions that you can go to investigate the behavior of this virus. One is that you can go on the internet and you can look up the word toxoplasmosis, T-O-X-O-P-L-A-S-M-O-S-I-S. And toxoplasmosis is a neurological virus which resembles in some, but not all of its properties, the archontic infection of the brain. And it's very interesting to hear from the scientist, what's his name? Zapralski. You find it on YouTube. It's a 20-minute talk on toxoplasmosis in which he refers to dopamine, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to do to have a clue and an inroad into this subject is to look at the book, The Mind Parasites, by Colin Wilson. Have you ever interviewed Colin Wilson, by the way?
Yes, we have. And of course, sadly, he passed away when, was it a couple of years ago now, maybe even more. And we were slated to actually do a second follow-up interview, but we did get 1 hour with Colin Wilson, and a very interesting man for sure.
Well, I knew him, and I used to see him in London when we were lecturing and talking on the same circuits. I didn't know that he'd passed away. Toxoplasmosis, Robert Sapolsky, S-A-P-O-L-S-K-Y. There is a 24-minute interview with him on YouTube that explains this remarkable infection. And there are certain things about toxoplasmosis that resemble the operations of this archonic infection. And also, if you read The Mind Parasites, or just go read about The Mind Parasites by Colin Wilson, well, remarkably, he stated some things about that sort of, you know how fiction, as it were, which is a product of human imagination, precedes fact.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he seems to have done that. You know, he was a polymath and a great genius, Colin Wilson. And in his genius, he seems to have picked up on this. The way that this bizarre situation can be stated so that everybody listening can grasp it and realize the magnitude of what I'm talking about is simple. I just pretend that I'm announcing to you the coming of a new film. And this film is called AI, not artificial intelligence, but archontic infection. And so I'm announcing to the world and I'm saying, what is the plot of this film? Very simple. The human species on Earth has been infected by an off-planet virus. How many science fiction themes have presented us that story?
Quite a bit.
Quite a few, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, according to the Gnostics, that's not fiction. It's fact.
Yeah.
But it is a fact that has to be investigated by use of special tools of cognition and the special method of telestic shamanism. As far as I know, if you want to know how the supernatural works, you got to go there.
Right.
And how do you go there? Well, you have to go out of the tonal, which is the ordinary state of mind, into the nahual, which is the non-ordinary supernatural state of mind. And you have to investigate it with the sobriety and discrimination and consistency and reason that you would investigate a complex crime scene in this world. That's what I'm in the process of doing, and I'm leaking it to you in this interview.
Yeah.
So some of what I say is going to be tentative. Some of what I say, I can tell you, I am absolutely convinced that this happened, and I can even give you a scenario of how it happened.
And of course, just to preface this here as well, this is in the extended investigation where you want to try to understand the mechanics of it, that if it is from a supernatural source, it might be impossible to solve the conundrum in the material world. But nonetheless, beyond that fact alone, it does not restrict itself to that realm, meaning we can actually see plenty of evidence for the infection, for the virus, right here in the material world.
Well, thank you for clarifying that way, because I had some reticence and some doubts. You know, I am my worst critic. There's nothing that anyone can throw at me, believe me, that's any worse than what I would throw at myself. I had considerable soul searching before I decided to talk to you about this, my friend.
Yeah, yeah. But
I can tell you that I am convinced and I am confident that my profile of the archonic infection drawn from Gnostic investigation is provable against the evidence of how it works in the world today. And we are at the threshold of that investigation, and it has to happen really, really fast. And the other thing that I want to add, and let's not leave this out, cannot leave this out, although we might have to do another talk rather toward the end of the month to get to this. I assure you who are listening that if you can hear me in the deepest sanity of your own minds, then you will resonate like a bell to what I'm going to say now. If there is a problem for the human species that has a supernatural origin, then it also has a supernatural solution. And the supernatural solution is what the Gnostics called Sophia's correction. It is when she corrects the problem of this infection. But she can only do it with a measure of human participation. She cannot do it entirely on her own, because we, humanity, are not the supreme species on this planet. We are the exceptional species, and we are of exceptional interest to the planetary animal mother. We are the pet creatures of this experiment in her eyes, and she needs our witnessing and our interaction in order to correct the experiment. And this is the moment of correction.
Let me just ask you here before we proceed and talk more about this here. There is see if we can detail this. We talked about the when this came upon mankind, the entering into the covenant here of what some called Yahweh or,
right.
Yal-Badaoth. Sorry, I'm mispronouncing that name. Yeah.
Yal-Dabaoth.
Yal-Dabaoth. That's right. That this is, initially, this is from a, potentially could have occurred to anybody, correct? I guess what I'm
That's
getting
right.
at closer at here is the question of whether this is a nature of a religious virus or if it indeed is something that is related to, let's say, genetics due to the neurological, kind of basis of the infection.
Well, that is the big question, isn't it? And doesn't it really baffle us? Because any of us who have taken the time, and it takes considerable time and huge determination, to try to work out this problem of the Jews. The problem of the Jews is not a problem that every single person who considers themselves a Jew is an agent of evil on this planet. Hell no. The problem of the Jews is the problem of Jewish identity and Jewish agenda. You know, that's the problem. And when you look into it, you always get slapped in the face, you know. It reminds me of that scene in Chinatown. Remember when Jake is slapping the Faye Dunaway character on the face and he's saying, well, what is she? Oh, my daughter. Oh, what is she? She's my daughter, my sister, my daughter, my sister. She's my daughter and my sister. You know, that scene. it's like this. Is it genetic? Is it ideological? Genetic, ideological. It's genetic and ideological. That's what's so insane about it. This neurological infection, which took root in certain people, it could have been anyone, and it could have been another racial group. It could have been Mongolians. It could have been some tribe of Japanese. It could have been some tribe of North American Indians who carry this neurological virus in its primary form. It has three forms. Class 1, class 2, and class 3. I'm in the process of profiling this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is neurological, and yet it is at the same time ideological. It is as if you could say, and I'm looking for analogies. I'm just getting started with this, Henrik, so I can't give as many convincing analogies as I might give. But just consider something like the St. Vitus dance. What is the St. Vitus dance? Isn't it what happened in the Middle Ages when people ate in moldy bread?
Ah, you're talking about the ergot and things like that.
Yeah,
okay.
They ate moldy bread.
Yeah.
And some of them had hallucinations. The paintings of Hieronymus Bosch are attributed to that, aren't they?
Yeah.
But someone who had this disease would act in a strange way. They would like dance around, you know, and jerk around like puppets, you know, like defective puppets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, if you just looking at it externally, you see that behavior and you're very puzzled by that behavior because you don't know that it is coming from a neurological condition, right?
Right.
So you might just say that behavior is crazy behavior. But when you know that it's coming from a neurological condition, then you can say it is both neurological and existential at the same time. There probably are better examples. There are very baffling. Go ahead.
Oh no, I just wanted to mention the obviousness of, for example, the nature of epigenetics. That it's actually it might be a nature of a mind state in itself that actually managed to change the chemical makeup of the brain, meaning that there is an interplay between ideology and, if you will, use that terminology, religion. That actually changes the genetics of the brain.
Well, at an advanced stage, that happens. At an advanced stage, the whole NLP of the brain is reprogrammed by religious beliefs and by ideology. We know this. And look at what's happening at the world today. Man, I'll step back for a moment. Maybe here I could illustrate to those who are listening the elucidative value of this proposition. There is some kind of massive mind control program spreading across this planet. And even though you can say, well, it's because certain people control the media and they control education, and you try to explain the mind control, the deployment and the implementation of that mind control program by mundane and conventional methods, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Everyone tries. They infiltrated. They took the long march through the institutions. They infiltrated the colleges and the universities. You know, they own the media companies, and you think about it and you think about it and you ponder it and you analyze it, and at the end of the day, there still remains some irreducible factor that cannot be explained rationally. How is it possible for such a massive conversion and infiltration of the human mind to occur?
Yeah.
And that's where you come to the boundary. I'm not saying that you can't explain this phenomenon of this archonic infection at all in conventional terms. I'm just saying that there's a boundary where you have to factor in the supernatural element. And when you factor in the supernatural element, according to the way I see it now, and according to what I'm learning in my investigations, then you understand why those who carry that virus need to eliminate the white race. In the intel that I'm investigating, I've come to the understanding that the white race is, quite simply, the Northern Nordic European races in particular, and the Caucasian races, have a high immunity to the virus. They're immune. And there's a very particular reason why they're immune. It's because, to some measure, they eat pork.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Huh. Mm-hmm. The taboo on eating pork is totally irrational. You may try to explain it any way you like.
That was the cleft feet and stuff, right?
That's right. You can explain it any way you like, you know. But as a matter of fact, the great majority of human beings eat pork and it doesn't bother them at all, does it?
Right.
So why is there a taboo against pork among the Jews and the Muslims? Because along with the archonic infection, which is neurological, I'm looking for the word right now, the archonic mind of Eyal Dabayot, that is Yahweh, Jehovah, and his horde of cyborgs, the archonic mind hacked into the human neurological circuits through this virus. And the archonic mind planted lies in the human mind. Now, what are those lies? Those lies are the lies that the Gnostics warned us about all those many centuries ago. For instance, let me read once again this sentence. Eyal Dabayot, that is the Lord of the Overlord of the Archons, a reptilian, shapeshifter, chose a certain man named Abraham from among the nations and made a covenant with him to the effect that if Abraham's seed continued to serve the Archons, they would give to Abraham the earth for an inheritance, end quote. Now, how do you know that statement is a fact, a statement of fact about something that occurred based on their telestic method of shamanic investigation? The Gnostics said, the Archons made a pact with this particular tribe and they gave the earth to them. But that's a lie because the earth was not theirs to give.
Right.
The earth was not theirs to give. The earth does not belong to the Archons. So how can the Archons, or how can Jehovah in the New Testament, as attested in many passages in Deuteronomy and elsewhere, tell the chosen people that he gives them something that he himself does not possess?
Yeah.
That is probably the supreme archontic lie. And that lie is being acted out today through the psychotic and murderous insanity of the people whose minds are literally neurologically infected with it. And you have to wonder why it doesn't bother them, why they can sit on hilltops in lounge chairs and scream and yell and applaud and drink wine,
yeah,
while they are watching women and children being burned to death and murdered, defenseless, with no arms, with no weapons.
Yeah.
You know, to wonder why? The human mind cannot even go there, Henrik. It can't go there.
Yeah.
It can't conceive anything that evil. But I'm telling you, we have to. We have to conceive this evil. And we have to admit that part of our understanding of it must come from an investigation of its supernatural factors.
Now, John, let's talk a little bit more about the evidence for the claim that the European and the Northern European specifically is being targeted for this. I want to try to get a little bit closer to the aspect of if people are still, I guess, in a point of maybe both neglect, but also the idea that they're not actually recognizing this issue and what that means in the extension of it. If it's true that there is a resistance innate, if you will, within a certain people, and if this is something that is going to go away, we can later talk about what that would mean, of course, what that would mean for the rest. But in terms of identification of the problem, let's talk a little bit more about that and the evidence for the claims that we've been so far talking about here, John.
Sure, sure. Again, this is another one of those considerations, one of those unfortunate conditions of being in the fog of war, you know. And it is important, however, to address the objections that come up immediately around this white genocide claim. You know, we're making a claim here, right? And so people are saying, oh, well, you know, you're just making that up, or if it's true, well, you deserve it. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
So it hasn't dawned on the majority of the population yet, that's for certain. But I can give you my sense that it's coming real, real fast. And it's coming a lot from the north, and from the north of Europe. And it's coming from England, and from the Asatru movement and the other indigenous movements. In fact, I was thinking at one point of coming out and saying if someone asked me in an interview, what are you doing, John? I would say, well, I'm creating panic. And then I would explain that I came up with this word panic, or it just sort of came to me spontaneously, you know, playfully, a while ago. P-A-N-I-C, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Pan-European Alliance of National Indigenous Cultures.
Mm, that's okay? A good one, yeah.
Panic. Let's like create panic,
yep.
You know, because I want to see the revival of National Indigenous Cultures, or what that young man, Dan, what's his name, Asatru?
Dan Rayner, exactly.
Would call, you know, the ethnic, you know, the ethnic cultures. But I also want to see them as a mosaic within a pan-European identity, you know?
I agree, very much so.
So yep. That, to me, panic is what I want to create, you know? And the word A, the letter A, refers to alliance. And alliance is really an important word in this formula, in this dream that I'm proposing, because alliance means that everyone has their sovereign identity as an ethnic group and a nation, but they are allied by bonds of agreement, you know?
Yeah.
So you could say in a way that panic is the absolute antithesis of the European Union. You know?
Exactly. And you know that that would cause panic as well if we saw a revival of the true nature of the indigenous European people and a pre-Christian one, a pre-Judaic one that is not influenced by these Semitic, tradition, one which is innate with our own, movements and folk and belief system. And I think that would be tremendously strengthening at a time like that. And I'm, to be honest and frank, I see this already. I see an automatic kind of not fallback. It's rather that they're going forward. It's not done in desperation because they feel they want to be, you know, beyond paleo conservative and just fall back as far as they can. I think it's rather a reach forward and realizing where we've been in the past and that we have a foot firmly in tradition and our ancestors, but at the same time going into something new, a new territory and forward, not just kind of back, you know?
That's exactly what I see. And I see it not as a reaction to the terrible plight and peril to the white races and humanity as a whole, you know, because after they wipe out the white races, they wipe out everybody else, because that is the nature of the archonic species. The archonic species cannot invade the earth. I want to make this point clear to those who followed my teachings about the archons. They cannot invade the earth because they cannot live within the atmosphere of the earth for a number of reasons. One is because oxygen is highly toxic to them. So they can only make short forays in their actual form, their sort of insectoid, Whitley Strieber, gray archon type of form, you know, cyborg. They can only make brief forays into the earth. They cannot have a planned invasion. That's why there is no planned invasion. There will be none. But were they able to do so, they would ravage this planet like locusts. You know, locusts have no plan. They just hit a field and they just level it. And then they go on to the next, you know? And that's what they would do to the earth. So we are facing that kind of danger in a science fiction scenario being enacted by human proxies within the species. But the overcoming and defeat of that cannot merely be a reaction. It is also a genuine resurgence of who humanity is and a genuine resurgence of our ethnic and folk awareness and of our love and attachment to our peoples, whether they be Latinos, Nigerians, Australians, Aborigines, Japanese, and a common love that unites us all, which is the love for the mother planet. So we have an opportunity for the revival and resurgence of those national indigenous cultures. It's a fantastic moment of opportunity. I'm very thrilled to be alive and to be able to be speaking of it and to define it for people. And I think that the role of the white Europeans is crucial in defining this resurgence, as we have done many times before, you know?
Yeah.
So that's encouraging. That's the hopeful part of this war we're in.
Well, it is a war, and I think it's important to realize that it comes from a place of love, actually, of all people, despite what those who try to claim otherwise are saying, despite this panic, to use that analogy again, there, that word again, due to the fact that there are more people that are returning to this and realizing that when there is a threat posed to them, there is, of course, a stronger unification, which in itself is a positive item, but it's moving so fast and so quickly that if we do not do anything about it, it might get out of control. And I mean, here is also when we can see some of the gleaming contradictions. For example, someone like Barbara Spector, when she, as a Jew, is willing to bring in these very so-called anti-Semitic Muslims into, for example, a country like Sweden, where the Jews themselves now are being targeted by the Muslim population. It is it's a war that has existed in other parts of the world that is now coming to Europe, even to North America and other parts of the world, where this virus, in my view, continues to spread, and now it's posing such a threat to everybody that we have to stand up and we have to realize what is happening and start doing something about it.
Well, I think that the people who haven't realized it by now are due for a big wake-up call soon, because if I were to continue in this analogy, I would say that the viral infection of this archontic factor is rampant. It is absolutely rapacious, and it's going to reach the point very, very soon where people won't be able to ignore it. You asked the question, which is a very valid question, that might be raised as an objection to our topic. You know, well, how do you know that this great danger, you know, that white genocide is real, or, you know? Well, for one thing, there are many things that point to the reality of it. We could talk for an hour about that, but I would just indicate one thing that any sane person of common sense can acknowledge. You can't be pro-white. You know, there's something about being pro-white that's taboo.
Yeah.
Well, why should that be? You know, you can be pro-Latino. You can celebrate African-American identity. You can celebrate Japanese identity. All these different ethnic identities on the planet can celebrate themselves, but white people cannot. Why not? You know, why isn't it equilateral? You know, that already is an alarm sign. The other alarm sign is that it's no secret. I mean, have you ever read The Synagogue of Satan? You know, read The Synagogue of Satan. Synagogue of Satan is a book that is just a compilation of quotes, right? Gathered by this particular individual. I forget his name right now.
Andrew Hitchcock, I think.
Yeah, Andrew Hitchcock. He's not putting out an agenda. He's not promoting some philosophy. He's just collected through history a set of quotes. And it's staggering to read these quotes. And it's truly jaw-dropping. So it's no secret that certain people on Earth have observed that there is an anti-human, anti-goy agenda on this planet. Okay?
Yeah.
And so today, the situation in Europe is problematical because it is taboo to state the obvious. Now, when it is taboo to state the obvious, I mean, suppose we're living in a little village somewhere in Sweden and suddenly 8 or 10 people come down with leprosy. So they're walking around in our little village and they've got leprosy, but oh, you're not supposed to say they have leprosy. I mean, that would be total insanity.
Yeah.
And if the community complied with that taboo, that would mean the end of the community virtually, right?
Yep.
Because the leprosy could spread in the community and people would be in denial of it. So even when they got it themselves, they would say, oh, leprosy, what's that? You know, this is how bad it is. And this, what's the saying of Voltaire? You know, if you want to know who's running the show, just ask who you can't criticize.
Yeah, that's right.
Who you can't talk about, you know? And so these are very obvious factors, and they're becoming more and more obvious every day. And we could go on about that. But I would like to address something, if I might, that came to my mind, Hendrik, as I was listening to a few of your interviews on the topic of white genocide recently. It seemed to me that you had a question, which was a very valid question, and I had it myself. And that is, we're starting to wake up, some of us are starting to wake up now to this agenda, even though it has been clearly and explicitly stated in certain writings and ideological scriptures, you know. But we're waking up to it in a state of, you know, of being stunned and baffled. I'll speak for myself here, but I think many people can relate. You scratch your head and you think, holy moly, how could it have gotten this far?
And how come I didn't see it sooner?
How come I didn't see it sooner? That's right. Well, I'd like to address those two questions, if I may. And I have to say that my response is not going to be easy. You may not like what I'm going to have to say, but I, to the best of my knowledge, I believe this explains why this happens. I will give you two perspectives to consider, my friends, and they both come from Gnosticism. Okay? Gnostics taught that the archons have no actual mind of intentionality. So it's not correct to say that they have a plan, these extraterrestrial mind parasites who work through human proxies. They don't actually have a plan. They are compelled by envy. And the Gnostics use this word, pathonos, the Greek word for envy, P-H-T-H-O-N-O-S. And they said that the operation of destruction conducted upon the human species by the archons and their proxies is a senseless act of envy, of destroying that which you want but cannot have. And I am also of the conclusion, although this is my little spin on Gnosticism, I have also concluded after much thought and much teaching and many errors, some of which I corrected, some of which I didn't, When the Gnostics defined humanity as the anthropos, they defined it as a creature without envy. Now, I've contemplated that a lot, so let me put it in the form of a question so that you can contemplate it. Do you think it would be correct to say, as the Gnostics seemingly said, that the human animal, the anthropos, the true human being, has no envy, and that where envy appears in human behavior, it is due to an infection of something non-human? Now, this is a subtle parapsychological profile, if you will. Now, I submit to you that I am convinced that it is true that the true human animal has no envy. And one of the things that convinces me of this is that I don't have any. And I'm a human animal. So how come I don't have any envy? What am I supposed to think of myself as some rare exception to the species? I don't think so, you know. I think I am. And I want to say what envy means. You know, I might want to, you know, jump on the bones of my neighbor's wife, you know, love your neighbor's wife, you know, that great biblical saying. And I might be jealous, you know, that he has this beautiful babe, or I might be jealous of somebody who has something that I want, but I don't go and destroy it so that they can't have it. That's envy.
Right. Yeah.
Envy is the senseless destruction which results in a condition when neither the person who has the desired thing nor the person who doesn't have it and want it gets it. Everything is lost. Envy is a zero-sum proposition. It's a complete failure. And so the envy of those, that special tribe of chosen people who made the pact with the Archons is, what do they envy? Well, let me put it together for you in a beautiful fairy tale fashion. The Archons lied, telling them, we will give you the earth for your inheritance. Well, the earth doesn't belong to the Archons. They can't give it to anyone. But the Aeon Sophia already gave the earth to humanity. Somebody envies that situation. Somebody envies the beauty of the human race, the simplicity, the genius of it. It's prodigiously talented, the variety of it, the innocence of it, particularly the innocence, and its connection to the planetary animal mother. Somebody envies that. And because they can't have that, because they made a deal connecting them to an extra human pathology, they will then destroy it, and the earth they inherit, they don't realize, will be a wasteland, and then the Archons will destroy them.
Yeah.
If you want to put the whole story of the chosen people into a fairy tale, that's it. And it has a very, very bad ending. Okay?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons, getting back to the main point here, stay on track, John, it's because you don't have envy, it's very difficult to see the insidious, nefarious, scheming, destructive insanity of people who do. That's why we haven't caught up with it, you know? It's like when you look at the world financial system. I only caught up with the world financial system about 4 or 5 years ago. And I had a wake-up call when I realized, hey, wait a minute. I remember in Santa Fe, I used to buy gas at 23 cents a gallon. Now it's like $4 a gallon.
Yeah.
Oh, why does gas get just more expensive? And why does the economy get worse? Well, I realized that it doesn't just happen that way. It happens because people make it happen that way.
Yeah.
You know? So when you realize that there is a deliberate factor of evil and destruction due to envy, you have to wake up. You have to not be naive. You use that word naive, and in a way it applies. But in another way, you know, it's not naivete. It's like you've got to be a warrior. And you've got to realize that somebody's out to kill you.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's, and this is where it's so difficult, I think, for a lot of people too, because they've maybe spent many, many of years of their lives of trying to get to a place of nonviolence, compassion, love for everybody, love for life and the earth and the environment and everything. And it's a, you know, kind of happy place with their, that they're trying to achieve. And into that picture, into that place that you're trying to create for yourself, comes this invading force of rage and violence, and in their view, hate and all the other nasty things that they've been trying to stay away from such a long time.
Right.
I guess my point in this has been, if you are part of a being that is on this planet, on this earth, it doesn't matter what you wish it to be, despite what some New Age philosophies tell you. You're part as a player on that chessboard, if you want to use that analogy. And when you're surrounded, you are faced with the option of trying to escape or resolve the issue in some way, defending yourself, doing something about it. And this fundamental basis, this fundamental point, is something which has been very, very cleverly inserted into, let's say, New Age ideology and a lot of other these philosophies that are flying around out there, that there's a removal from, as you said, the human animal, the human being, from the natural world, the natural order, where even our most basic drives and responses and even functions of our very brain has been dismantled and deconstructed in front of us. And we now have a majority of people, I'd say, on this planet, which are in complete compliance, really, with the slave agenda of not even being a human being, but being a perfectly fine domesticated animal in their playpen. And this is something that people have to realize. This is not a natural state of a human being.
No, it isn't. It's not natural at all. And I would sum up what you're saying, if I might paraphrase it or put it into a proposition. To be a real, genuine human being who wants all those good things, you know, who wants mutual aid and comes from love and generosity and doing no harm, you want to be that. Okay. But you cannot be that if you evade and deny the evil done by human beings. And you must see that you are implicated in that evil. And therefore, your responsibility for being human cannot really reside exclusively on playing the good side of human nature. It can't.
Yeah.
I love that saying, and I quoted this years ago in some of the writings I did on metahistory.org. The book, The Serpent and the Rainbow by Wade Davis, is about Haiti. Beautiful book, incredible book about the origins of voodoo. Profoundly beautiful book. And in that book, he says that look into the mirror of evil and you do not see the evil in yourself. What you see is the goodness in yourself. This is a really profound statement. Unless we look at this evil and face it brutally and nakedly, we can never know what it means to be really good people. Good people are people who face it, not try to deny and evade it according to these New Age formulas and forgiveness and all of the other conditioning that is actually used by the perpetrators in order to protect themselves. You see?
Yeah.
I am convinced that the moment of truth has come, and it is coming like with lightning speed. But we have been slow on uptake here.
Yeah.
And I'd like to give you another reason why. And what I'm going to tell you now is pure Gnostic intel. And it's very difficult to swallow. It's very difficult. A lot of people balk on this. But I am convinced, I have had extensive conversations about this with people to check my sobriety. This is really hard to accept. But I think if you can accept this, it will make a great difference. And it will explain why the archontic trickster and those who perpetrate evil against humanity have the upper hand. Why do they seem to have the upper hand and indeed have had the upper hand in many cases? Well, I ask you to recall a Gnostic teaching that has been totally discarded and considered as ridiculous and not even worth discussing by all scholars of Gnosticism except John Lash. It is said that the Gnostics were, quote, against procreation, end quote. Now, this comes down to us as a rumor, a sort of a rumor from the arguments between the early church fathers and the Gnostics. You understand?
Yeah.
And it is said, you pick up fragments of it. You don't find in the Coptic or Greek materials an actual exposition of why the Gnostics were against procreation, put it in quotes. But you find references to it in the Irenaeus and the others. You get that?
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, it seems like absurd. How could they be against procreation? We were made by nature like other species. We propagate by meiosis, which is sexual conjugation of the male and female members of the species, and we produce our species, and procreation is necessary for us to survive, right? How could they be against procreation? Doesn't make any sense, right? This is what they were against. They were against procreation on two counts. The first count is that they detected that the archontic factor in the mind parasite, which is behind all of this anti-human activity, would use procreation as a weapon. Now, does that ring a bell to anyone living in Sweden?
Right. I think I know where you're going.
You think you know what I'm referring to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That they would use the natural and good function of reproduction in our species, that they would co-opt that to their purposes. Therefore, they would use what we now today call mass immigration as a weapon. They actually saw that coming. They saw that the archons would, in effect, hijack and subvert our reproductive functions in that way. They do it in many other ways as well.
Yeah.
Talk about transhumanism and all that, but we'll leave that subject aside for a moment. The second point is the real sticker, man. This is the real sticker. What they meant when they said that they were against procreation was that they were alarmed and deeply concerned about neoteny in the human species. N-E-O-T-E-N-Y, neoteny. Neoteny means the condition of being born before you are mature. It's also called juvenilism. Now, one of the things that warriors in this battle for humanity do is they base their warrior ethics concerning life and death and love and loyalty. They base all their ethics on nature. So let's go and look at nature. And let's say, look at the way animals are born. Look at a young colt. How long does it take for a young colt to stand up after it's born?
Very quick.
How long does it? Yeah, it gets its mother's milk, which has immune hormones in it. Very quickly, it's frolicking around. Look at the little lambs that are born out here in the hills of Andalusia in the spring and fall. How quickly they function. Look at all the animal species. Look at a nest of birds. Look at robins. Look at blackbirds. As soon as they get out of the nest, they know how to pick worms. They know where to fly. Look at all the species of nature, whether they be birds, insects, snakes, animals. There is no neoteny. That is to say, quite soon after the offspring are produced, the offspring is mature to function on its inherited instinctual programs. Now look at the human species. Now look at the vulnerability of our species due to the exceptional status of neoteny. When we are born, the brain isn't even formed yet. You know that. The most important organ in the human body for its orientation to the world and for action and conception is still not completely formed. It only forms much, much later. So we are born with an immature brain. We're born with immature faculties of sight, taste, touch. We're born with an inability to manage our four limbs. All of these are the factors of neoteny. And what the Gnostics objected to was they were against procreation. What they meant, to paraphrase it, is that they were against the condition of neoteny that is due to the way we reproduce. And they also thought that the Aeon Sophia, who designed the human genome, never meant for us to reproduce in this way in the first place. But that's another story. That's part of the myth. The fact is that we do reproduce this way. And the unfortunate consequence of that, my friends, is what you see when you see children in a madrasi, when you see children in Sunday school, when you see young Jewish boys in the yeshiva nodding their heads and reading meticulously every line of the Torah, when you see 6 months old children with an iPad in its hand, when you see children in a trance in front of a television, neoteny subjects the human being to massive behavioral program before it has the discernment and discrimination to resist.
Right. Yeah.
And so all of us, and that includes me with everybody else, from the time that we were a child, were imprinted while we were in the stage of development and received input before we were able to handle it, before we were mature enough to evaluate it and assess it. Consequently, we come into life, into our teen years and into our adult years, rather than being the thriving, prodigious geniuses that she designed us to be, we are products of imprinting. And you, Henrik, and I, and everyone else who is now able to stand in front of this peril to humanity and face it, have already won one of the biggest battles we'll ever fight. And that is the fight to get over your mental and psychological conditioning that prevents you from seeing reality.
Yeah.
And if we were not neotenous, we would not have to fight that battle. But we are. That is an unfortunate condition of the way we reproduce. But we can compensate for that. We can compensate for that neoteny by very simple measures. There are two simple measures that human beings can practice. I'm talking about families now and communities. One, we raise the child in nature. We let the child learn from the natural world and bond to the natural world. Empathy with nature and with the planetary animal mother raises the human animal to its true potential of intelligence and compassion. And so, although the vulnerability of neoteny remains, the child is able to boot itself up into its proper human potential when it is raised in nature. Second thing we do is that the community preserves the story of the peoples. It reserves, as Dan Rayner says, the reverence and love for the folk.
Yeah.
And teaches the history of the folk, not just the family histories, but the phylogenetic history that was taught for many centuries by the bards, like the bards of Iceland, the bards of England and Ireland, the bards of Germany.
Yeah. The Skald.
The Skald. Every tribe had the Skald. And the role of the Skald, which is somewhat also the role of the shaman, such as myself, is to carry the memory of the folk.
This is so tremendously important. I mean, I can't emphasize this enough. Why are we... I'm amazed, John, at how many people, they don't even know beyond their own grandparents, their own family, what happened. There's no... The story is severed after generation after generation after generation, and there's a myopia there. It's not a continuity to who we are and where it comes from. So, I mean, we know that certainly part of this is attributed to the church and the state and religion and you know, the nature of the conditioning of the infection, as we've been talking about. But despite all that. That we haven't awakened, I guess this goes back to what you talked about before in a way then, but that we haven't awakened to this aspect, that we can carry on the story to those who come after us, our children, or you know, even those we know, if we have an uncle or if we have a brother who has a child or some other relative. But this seems not to have happened for some tragic reason, you know?
Well, I can tell you exactly why that happened and when and how. But first, let me say that I am happy to say that I am living with you in the moment when that, when we recover that. And I am tracing very closely that process of recovery out of investigation of the phylogenetic memory circuits of the earth itself, which is something that shamans can do. The reason why those skulls and those bards like Taliesin, you know, the Welsh bard Taliesin, there is a poem from Taliesin in which he recites previous incarnations and he recites things that happened in history and prehistory and even out in the external parts of the galaxy in his poem. How is Taliesin, who is the typical tribal bard, able to do this? Because through the correct practices of shamanism, the bard accesses the phylogenetic memory circuits of the earth itself. And the folk memory of all the peoples who have lived on the earth are comprised in her circuits. And what is happening now, and this is part of her correction, and I feel huge joy and confidence when I say this, is that the return and revival and opening up of those folk memory circuits is happening. Mm. You know, there's been quite a bit of talk about this Borg saga.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Borg saga.
Borg saga. Mm-hmm. Borg saga. This is a sterling example of it, you know? The example of the Anastasia stories and the Singing Oaks is sort of an example of it, but not exactly, because it's a fictionalized or fabulized version of it, but it's an attempt in the right direction anyway. It's a sign that the phylogenetic memory circuits of the Russian people are awakening. And we're going to see this in spectacular fashion. I don't usually make predictions, but I can tell you that I see this coming. And the return of racial memory brings back to people the sense of the morality that we had before it all went bananas, you know,
yeah,
before it all went into an incredible blur. And I'll tell you exactly why it went into an incredible blur. And it wasn't that long ago, Henrik, that we lost the continuity with these folk memory circuits. Not at all. I'll give you an example. William Butler Yeats, who was an esoteric poet and mystic of the Irish tradition, was very involved with theosophy. And he had a friend called Lady Gregory, and they were Celtic revivalists, along with George Russell, A.E. And this movement of the Celtic revival happened at the end of the 19th century and early in the 20th century, although it was disturbed by the First and Second World War. And they realized at that time that it was necessary to go back and to the people who carried this oral tradition and write down the stories that they remembered. So already, only 100 years ago, in the time of Yeats and Lady Gregory, there were people like us today who said, we must pull back, we must recapture and pull back the threads of our folk memory in order to have the sense of our humanity and where we are going and how to be moral. And so that is repeating itself now in a number of ways. But the reason why the continuity was broken goes back to 1850. It goes back to the middle of the 19th century. Now, there are a number of things that happened around a 20-year period between 1850 and 1870 that can be considered as an obliterating attack upon humanity, that have resulted in almost a complete break with the continuity of our racial memory systems. One of them was the liberation of the Jews. People don't know about this. Go look it up on the internet. The liberation of the Jews. The Jews were liberated around 1849 all across Europe. That means that up until that time, they had been segregated. Like, for instance, you might do with someone who is carrying a virus. They've been segregated, and as you know, they had been expelled from what? How many countries over 2,000 years?
Tremendous amounts. 1,000, 1,200, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Over 1,000 expulsions, better than one every 20 years for 1,800 years, okay?
And there's nothing to that except, of course, just European psychosis, right?
Oh, yeah. That's our problem.
Right. Yeah.
That's our problem. Yeah. There must be something wrong with us.
Yes.
Because Jews are perfect.
That's right.
They are. They can never do anything wrong. So there must be something. They can't perform evil, commit evil like we can. I could commit evil, you know? And whites have certainly committed a lot of evil, but Jews are incapable of committing evil.
Yeah.
We know that. So somebody, and I don't know the story behind this, I'd love to hear your interview with the person who breaks this one, decided that they were going to let the Jews into all the institutions of European life around 1850. I would point out to you a synchronicity that is extremely alarming, but it proves my case about the supernatural factor in the war against humanity. That was a perfectly mundane event. Rules were written, rules were changed, countries adopted different policies, just like Sweden adopted, for some mysterious reason, a policy of massive Muslim immigration. That was all mundane. But at the very same period of history, photography came to this planet. And photography followed by movies and the electronic media is a direct instrument of the Archons. Photography and the movies and television have done more to destroy the folk memory than any other single thing on this planet. You know, I used to travel years ago in Asia and in beautiful back roads of Thailand and a lot of remote places. And I can still remember villages where there was no television. But I guarantee you, if you go into any village in Nepal, in remote village in China, all around the world, in Patagonia, you name it, you're going to find the local tribal indigenous people, insofar as there are any surviving, sitting down, and what are they doing?
They're in trance in front of the blue light of the box, you know, mesmerized.
The blue flicker of the box. Yeah. They're in trance in front of television. So I'm not saying that photography and movies and television is not a technology that could have its positive uses and its correct uses. But what I'm saying is that the Archons made a massive assault upon the human race with this archontic technology, because the nature of everything that the Archons do is mimetic. It's simulation.
This is what circumvented our idea of telling our own stories, of sitting
That's
around
right.
the fire and sharing the story of our people, right?
That's right. And for instance, you have probably seen the movie, the excellent documentary about how Thomas Edison was at the foundation of the movie industry in the United States. And that was on the East Coast. And he didn't want to work with any Jews. So he threw them out. He wouldn't let them get positions in the new industry of pictures, you know, first silent pictures and then talkies. And so they went to Hollywood and they founded their own dynasty of movies. Okay?
Their own empire,
Their own empire. And the story of this is very well documented. It's not anti-Semitic propaganda. It's
nope,
a fact.
That's right.
In fact, they're very happy to say today that they control Hollywood and they won't let you in if you don't get their seal of approval, if you're not Jewish. So the point I'm making is that there have been a few movies that have been made that have told stories that are valid and valuable. But for the most part, films have fed us with a fraudulent history. And fraud and simulation are the marks of the Archons. And so I have to admit, and I'll tell you, until about 6 years ago, the only thing I knew about the Gestapo and the Nazis and their alleged program to exterminate the Jews came from Hollywood movies.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I had never examined I had never watched Eichmann's Confession at the Nuremberg trials. Everybody should watch that, by the way. It's hilarious.
Very bizarre, yeah.
Oof. Very, very bizarre, right? I had never investigated the archaeological, forensic, scientific intelligence of the Holocaust. Everything that I thought about the Holocaust came from Hollywood movies. And so the mind programming potential of this simulation technology of photography and films was a tremendous breakthrough of the archons into the human mind. And it is that which has wiped out our continuity. And it's even wiped out people's interest. They're not even interested anymore in the story of the Eddas, in the story of the romances of chivalry of the Middle Ages, of Parzival, you know,
yeah,
of the foundation myths of all the European nations, you know?
Yeah.
They're not.
Exactly. Because as we said, it's been hijacked, and it's such a it's a tremendously powerful weapon and something that they have at their disposal. And I think we're still kind of reeling with this, of trying to play catch up to a certain extent of understanding what has happened to us.
We are. Yeah. We're trying to play catch up. We really didn't see it coming. And what I'm saying is the reasons why we didn't see it coming are very valid. First of all, it's still hard for me today. I can get duped today. You know, Mark Twain said, and he was a goy, but he said something that all goys should have in needlepoint on the wall of their house. It's easier to dupe someone than to convince them that they have been duped, you know?
Yeah.
That's the pure nature of the goy.
Yeah.
You know, and the anti-goy know that. You know? And so once you understand it, I mean, I think you can kind of maybe breathe a sigh of relief and say, you know, wow, no wonder they got the upper hand, because we weren't expected to be deceived and subjected to fraud at every turn in the road, because that is not human nature, you know? And they took the technology. I mean, filmmaking, I'd love to make a film. I've written film scenarios. It could be the most tremendous tool to lead humanity to its true potential.
We have to get into it.
We have to take
the reins of that industry and do our own movies.
Back. Yeah, that's we have to yeah. take it back from those who hijacked it,
yeah.
because they're using it against us.
Yeah,
and this is a very, very great concern for me. So back to your question, you know, how could we have lost our grounding and our rooting in those folk memory circuits? Well, I assure you that those folk memory circuits are alive and well, and that they can be revived and regenerated quickly and rapidly. And that is indeed part of what I see as the grand scenario of Sophia's correction.
Let me comment on the return of racial memory of the stories that we've gone through. I think that this would unlock the association with, you know, not only who you are, but the love for your people. And this is something that would potentially work against this kind of you know, self-hate that we're seeing. I mean, an appreciation for who you are and where you come from. I mean, there's been a resentment, I think, for who we are. And dare I say it, especially the white race, there are a lot of people out there amongst our own ranks that feel tremendously good about feeling bad about themselves, of who they are. I would argue that
that's right.
One of the biggest obstacles actually exists within our own ranks. They have managed to shame our history and mythologize our history. And this is something we have to just kind of pass through in order to get our place back, you know?
Yeah, well, they're a bunch of losers. And people who categorically hate the white race and state that those of members of humanity of the white race, which is only about 8%, have done the worst on this planet, are fools. They're fools. They've been duped. They've been conned. It is absolutely untrue. They have been infected by a pathology of hatred, and their own lives are, you know, they are miserable losers and underachievers. And I guess they get some satisfaction by trying to tear down a race, an ethnic group of the human species that has achieved excellence of an incomparable level. And I dare anybody to say it isn't so.
Yeah.
You know, I want people to do an exercise in excellence. Let's throw away this word supremacy. We'll give that to the Jews. They like that word. I don't like the word supremacy. I'm not a white supremacist. I'm a white aretist. The word, the Greek word, arete, A-R-E-T-E, means excellence. I'm a white erratist.
Mm.
And I defy anybody to take a big sheet of paper, as big as the wall of a room, and put on this paper five or six different ethnic groups. Blacks, Latinos, Mexicans, put on the Jews if you want, Persians, and European whites. And then I want you to put down, counting forward from 1500, the achievements of excellence of those people. And I'm going to ask you, what's going to be the longest list?
Yeah.
So I will not fracking stand for it.
Yeah.
I really won't. It's a lie, and it's a lie that people buy because they are pathetic losers in their own lives, and they need to blame somebody. And I will not be blamed, especially for something that I never did. And it is one of the greatest crimes on the earth is to blame the German people today and extract and extort millions and millions of dollars of reparation from them for something that they never did. And when this comes out, the blowback is like nothing this world has ever seen.
Yeah.
And it is simmering at the edges. I swear to you, if my gut detection of what's happening on this planet is correct, it is simmering. And when the blowback falls on the sources of that fraud and that lie, they would not be able to go and find a place to hide.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suggest put on a lead suit and drop into the bottom of the Dead Sea. It's the lowest place on Earth, and it seems to be an appropriate place for you to hang out. If you're of that persuasion.
Well, it's a crime what we've seen going on.
It's a horrible crime.
Yeah.
But like any other crime, it can be overturned by the proof of the evidence. The only way to maintain that crime is to hide the evidence and to suppress the evidence that contradicts the official narrative. And there, it's my view that the people who are attempting to do that are losing control. They're losing control of the narrative.
Yeah.
Another thing that happens in Sophia's correction is that the archonic proxies and those in the service of the war guard trickster lose control of the narrative. I want to emphasize this again. I don't often repeat myself, but there are some things I feel I need to repeat. If you are one of those human animals today that holds it in your heart, your highest desire and passion is to see a life of pleasure and mutual aid on this planet. Never perfect. There'll be conflicts, there'll be disagreements, but the general mood will be very different than it is now. If you want to see that and you recognize the narrative that is preventing that from happening, you must also recognize that it is not enough to defeat and overcome that narrative. There must be another narrative to replace it. I've said this over and over again. The human being is a storytelling animal. We rely on stories for our identity, for our direction. There has to be one story that gives solution on the planetary scale. Now, there can be many local solutions. There can be solution to the social problems in Sweden. There can be solution to the border problem in Mexico and the United States. There can be local solutions in families, local solutions in communities. Correction is all about humanity taking responsibility for these solutions. But all of these solutions, local in particular, have to be united in the solution on the planetary scale. And that solution is the story of the planet itself. It comprises all of the folk tales. I can draw from Icelandic mythology and show you the Sophianic elements. I can draw from American Indian mythology and show you the Sophianic elements. I can draw from Hindu mythology or Teutonic. But all of those are only contributing elements to the master narrative. That is why bringing back to humanity the master narrative of this planet is the most important thing that I ever did, in my own estimation. And that master narrative is part of the correction. You say how important stories are. You know, I don't really know you. We're friends in the spirit of Maitreya, which is the friendship of strangers, the friendship of people who may never meet or do never meet. The friendship of strangers is also happening now on this planet through the internet. People are friends with other people all around the world that they'll never meet. But yeah. What is uniting and pulling us all together? There is an omega point. And that omega point is her story. We are all characters in her story. And if you love the earth, then knowing her story proves that you love her. If I get to love you as an intimate friend, then I know your life story and you know mine. It's the same with the earth. Everyone of all the different nations and countries and cultures can come into the alliance and solidarity of loving her story. And within that, I want to see the flowering of every single indigenous nation on this planet.
Very good, John. The truth is going to get out, and I think we won't be able to cower to the PC bullshit much longer, cower to the words and not take our responsibility to, you know, protect ourselves and our people, our land, and recognize that there is a conquest ideology out there and a genocide in effect, no matter if you've recognized it yet or not. But this very aspect, John, is something that we're going to get into and discuss more in our second program about how to fight this battle, how to get into this this frankly war that is being waged, and what the nature of this is, and how to begin to combat this infection and virus that we've been talking about today. So that's next up on our agenda.
That's the direction we're going. That's next up. And to do that, I would start with a story, which is the story of Parzival, and who was a warrior, who was a knight. And I would like to introduce that story and begin with that story and lead into what I consider to be the overriding factor in the planetary solution. And that is a warrior class, the forming of a warrior class.
Yeah.
So that, which is what I call the Calico War Party. So fabulous. That's where we'll pick it up next.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Well, thank you, John, so much for talking with us about this extremely important topic and issue. Why don't we just wrap up here then for this time, John, and give us your website again where people can go and give us the title of your book again for kind of much of the background of the Gnostic story we've been kind of weaving in and out of this program here.
Not in His Image is my book. And the two websites to visit are metahistory.org, that's M-E-T-A, history.org. It presents the Sophianic myth, the Sophianic sacred narrative, if you will, and a great deal of material on Gnosticism, and also a lot of material on the warrior ethic and some things along that line. And then there is, of course, GaiaSpora.org, GaiaSpora.org. And that was the platform for the Gaia Navigation Experiment, which I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. Thanks so much, Henrik. I feel like we're striding side by side and shoulder to shoulder here. I've known you for some years now, and it's a great privilege and pleasure for me to come together with you. This is our mission. No doubt about it.
Yeah, that's right. I agree. Same here. Thank you so much, John. We'll pick this up in a little bit. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have a second program with John Lash coming up in a few weeks, if all goes as planned, and discuss the next step in this tactic and what strategy to adopt in order to clean up the infection and prevent what has been planned. Next coming up, we have Jack Donovan on Radio 314. Then on Red Ice Radio, we have Janice Barcelo to talk about the dark side of IVF. We'll also talk about infertility, what to do about it, who is behind the IVF industry, and whose genetics is being stolen in the process. We also have Mark Passio on the New Age Revolt against nature. Upcoming, we have Zen Gardner, Dennis Weiss, and many more coming on after this, so stay tuned. Thank you for listening today. If you want full access to all our previous programs and to the second hour of most of our shows, please sign up at redicemembers.com. We come to you 3 times per week without commercial interruptions and an ad-free website, so thank you for your support. Also, my thanks to the Red Ice crew. By the way, we have a new video coming out soon. Keep an eye out for that. It'll be linked up on the websites. We'll be back then in just a few days. Take care, both of body and mind, and we'll speak to you soon.